KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We don't have a more comprehensive way to ensure that companies are not collecting more data than they should.
DeepSeek is a new AI star, but what happens to all the data the chatbot collects?
For Friday, January 31st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. President Trump has promised sweeping changes when it comes to electric vehicles.
He plans to roll back Biden-backed policies to support cleaner cars.
The global stage is still moving in this direction, so automakers still have to develop the technology and be able to work with it, because they're going to have to sell it somewhere else.
Also, since taking office, President Trump has already fired people who prosecuted him.
What future plans does he have for the Justice Department?
And it's been 4 years since Myanmar's military deposed the elected government.
There are pockets of famine all over the country. The situation is quite bleak.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Recovery operations are continuing in the Potomac River in Washington, D.C., 2 days after a deadly collision between a passenger plane and a military helicopter. In the meantime, helicopter flights near Ronald Reagan National Airport have been restricted. NPR's Joel Rose reports the investigation into the crash is ongoing.
The Federal Aviation Administration will limit helicopter flights on routes along the Potomac River near the airport, as well as over the airport itself. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said today, quote, said that would, quote, help secure the airspace near Reagan Airport, ensuring the safety of airplane and helicopter traffic, unquote.
That's NPR's Joel Rose reporting. Federal agencies were scrambling to meet a deadline today to purge programs and content related to gender issues. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the departments had until the close of business this afternoon to complete the work.
The directive called for the elimination of agency programs promoting, quote, gender ideology, as well as content on government websites and social media accounts. President Trump was asked about websites possibly being taken down in order to scrub for content involving diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. He said he didn't know of that happening, but that...
It doesn't sound like a bad idea to me. DEI would have ruined our country, and now it's dead. I think DEI is dead, so if they want to scrub the websites, that's okay with me.
The website of the National Institute of Health's Office for Sexual and Gender Minority Research Office disappeared. Several web pages from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention with reference to LGBTQ plus health also disappeared. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
A Louisiana mother and a New York doctor have been indicted for allegedly providing abortion medication to a minor in Louisiana. Rosemary Westwood with member station WWNO reports it's the first case of its kind in the state where abortions have been illegal since the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
A West Baton Rouge grand jury handed down the indictments. Assistant District Attorney Tony Clayton said he will prosecute the case.
The charges aiding and abetting in the commission of an abortion in the state of Louisiana, which is a crime.
Clayton told the news show Talk Louisiana that he plans to seek a warrant for Dr. Margaret Carpenter, despite New York laws that protect physicians who mail abortion medication to states where abortions are illegal.
But you can't hide behind the borders of New York and ship pills down here to commit abortions in Louisiana.
Clayton said he will not seek charges against the minor who was given abortion medication by her mother. For NPR News, I'm Rosemary Westwood in New Orleans.
At the close on Wall Street, the Dow was down 337 points. This is NPR News in Washington. Authorities in Pennsylvania say a small plane has crashed into a shopping mall in northeast Philadelphia. It remains unclear where the flight had originated from and what led to the crash. Videos on social media show a thick cloud of smoke in the sky near the crash site. Emergency crews are working to put out the fire after the plane crashed into the mall and into several nearby buildings. The Grammy Awards will take place in Los Angeles this weekend, but the city is still recovering from wildfires. Recording Academy officials explained their decision to go on with this year's show. NPR's Sydney Madden has more.
It's called Music's Biggest Night for a reason. But almost a month after wildfires ravaged many parts of LA, this year's Grammy Awards will be different. Major record labels have canceled parties leading up to the big night, but the Recording Academy has made the decision to proceed with the ceremony and use it for good. Harvey Mason Jr., CEO of the Recording Academy, shared that the ceremony will feature fundraising call-outs throughout the night to support wildfire relief efforts, including those for musicians and industry professionals who've lost their homes. The 67th Annual Grammy Awards will take place live from Crypto.com Arena in LA this Sunday, February 2nd. Sydney Madden, NPR News.
Stocks traded lower across the board on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 337 points. The Nasdaq Composite down 54. The S&P 500 fell 30 points. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Chinese AI chatbot DeepSeek has taken over the conversation around AI. It shot to the top of App Store charts, it stunned Silicon Valley, and it briefly plummeted the stock market. But there's one question that didn't get much attention. What is DeepSeek doing with all of this data it's collecting? NPR's Bobby Allen has looked into this and joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Bobby, start if you can by talking a bit about how much data DeepSeek is harvesting. Is it comparable to the amount of data that ChatGPT gathers?
It's comparable, yeah. In fact, every time someone asks either of the chatbots a question, that is new data that's making these things smarter. Now, DeepSeek is an open source model, so anyone can build apps off of its underlying code. And, you know, it's pretty upfront about what it's collecting in its privacy policy. Not just all the questions people are asking, but also information on what device you're using, your keystroke patterns, your location, what you're doing on other websites and apps, and just a lot more, right? DeepSeek never got back to us for comment. But look, I think, you know, we're kind of used to hearing about chatbots or social media apps like Facebook and Instagram just collecting tons of data on us. But DeepSeek is different, Juana, because all of this personal and identifying info is being stored on servers in China.
Right. And having a connection to China has, of course, as many know, become a big problem for TikTok. Could the U.S. government see a problem here, too?
Potentially, and for similar reasons, right? China policy experts and lawmakers worry about the Chinese government using data on Americans against them, whether it could be used to one day, you know, blackmail a federal employee or some, you know, a military personnel, or figure out someone's interests and then sort of use that to try to target them with disinformation. It's why there's, you know, long been bipartisan concern in Washington about apps and services based in China. And it's why now TikTok is technically banned in the U.S., even though President Trump is, as we know, trying to figure out a long-term solution for the app. And it's why there are now growing questions and concerns about DeepSeek from members of Congress. I called up Sam Sachs about this. She studies Chinese cybersecurity at Yale. And here is her advice on using DeepSeek.
If you are a U.S. government official, if you have information that's potentially sensitive, if you're someone that thinks I might be subject to a blackmail campaign, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, but Sachs says no matter who you are, your information is probably already being bought and sold by data brokers. In other words, if you're a very online person, Juana, the ship has kind of sailed on data privacy.
Got it. Well, I mean, are there any ways that privacy advocates suggest that people can use DeepSeek more safely?
Yeah, there are. They suggest creating an account with DeepSeek by not logging on through your Google and Apple account. That might be the easier way to do it, but it's of the riskier way. Don't ask it questions that include personal information about yourself. You can also, you know, access it through a virtual private network, a VPN, to hide your location.
Does the U.S. have any digital privacy laws?
No. Sachs of Yale says it's really up to all of us to come up with our own ways of protecting data, since Congress still has not passed a federal comprehensive privacy law like the EU has. There are strict privacy rules there, of course, that, you know, require consumers to opt into any data collection. But in the U.S., we keep having debates about individual apps in China. Here's Sachs again.
We can ban TikTok. We can raise the red flag of data security concerns for DeepSeek. But we don't have a more comprehensive way to ensure that companies are not collecting more data than they should.
And no way, of course, of having control over where that data is stored and who can access it, whether a private company or an adversarial government. So Sachs says legislation here is sorely needed.
NPR's Bobby Allen, thank you.
Thanks, Juana.
In the world of figure skating, this week's fatal plane collision near Washington, D.C. resurfaced memories of a similar disaster more than 60 years ago. A flight carrying the U.S. figure skating team crashed in Belgium and killed dozens of athletes and coaches and their family members. That loss affected the sports for years. With the help of member station GBH in Boston, NPR's Becky Sullivan has this story.
On Thursday at the Skating Club of Boston, a man named Paul George stopped to look at an old photo.
This is Greg Kelly, Maribel Owen, and Dudley Richards. They were a pair team. Lawrence Owen and Batty Lord.
Back in 1961, George was an aspiring figure skater. He trained at the skating club, where he worked out alongside some of the very best skaters in the whole country. He said they all posed for this team photo at the national championships that January.
So that's the team that competed in 61. Several, of course, lost their lives in the plane crash.
It was just a few weeks later that the senior U.S. figure skating team boarded a plane in New York bound for Brussels. They were headed to Prague for the world championships. Just before the Boeing 707 landed in Brussels, something went wrong, and the plane went down. In total, 18 U.S. figure skaters died in the crash, along with six coaches and some family members and officials.
It was stunning. I was 19 years old. It was a stunning moment because I lost in that plane crash people I trained with, people that I socialized with. We all grew up together. We horsed around together. So it was a very, very stark moment.
When that happened, it just like everything just took the rug out from underneath everyone.
Peggy Fleming was only 12 then, but already a promising young talent. Her coach at the time was on that flight, as she recalled to StoryCorps a few years ago.
I mean, not only losing all the talent in skating, all of the role models for people like me to look up to were all gone, but also our top coaches all across the country were gone.
The crash was a shock to the system for U.S. figure skating. It took everyone a little while to even put on their skates again. For Fleming, just a kid then, the only way she could ease back in, she said, was by taking lessons from a friend of her old coaches, someone who could share what they were all going
through.
The
delay here. See the delay in the up in the first part of that jump? Beautiful.
Ultimately, Fleming and George say they ended up more committed to the sport. By the mid-60s, Fleming was winning championships. In 1968, she won the Olympic gold medal. A win that was especially emotional given what had happened just 7 years before, as she and George remembered together on StoryCorps.
For me to make it was like, it gave hope to, I think, the general public in the U.S.
It gave
and
hope
maybe
to the sport, too, because the sport had really, after the crash, it had a lot of rebuilding.
Still, for years, the shadow hung over the world of figure skating. Younger kids born after the crash grew up feeling like it was something they could never talk about, said Doug Zagheib, who now runs the Skating Club of Boston.
I hope we don't have the same situation here. I hope we can be a little bit healthier about it, talk about it, acknowledge it, celebrate these kids, celebrate these coaches and their parents, the kids' parents, and keep them alive that way.
Aboard Wednesday's flight were about a dozen skaters, all of them teenagers or even younger, who were coming home after taking part in a prestigious development camp in Wichita. At least four coaches were on the plane, too, and some family members traveling with them. Some were from the D.C. area, others skated in Delaware, and a few were from the Boston Club, the very place where George trained once upon a time.
I described it as the day the music stopped, and the music didn't play. The ice wasn't covered. There was nobody on it for a couple of weeks. I feel the same here today. The ice is empty. There's not a soul out there. I think that will go on for a bit, and then people will come back and work harder.
On Instagram, the accounts of victims still have the fresh photos from this week's development camp. Group shots of happy kids, elite young athletes beaming with pride and excitement at their accomplishments, the same as it was in that old 1961 team photo of George and his fellow skaters. With help from GBH in Boston, I'm Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Washington.
For more than 100 years, scientists have known about a tiny mammal living in the mountains around Yosemite National Park. California even designated it a species of special concern. But nobody had ever seen the Mount Lyell shrew.
There's never actually been even a confirmed sighting of the shrew alive, just because they're almost always found dead.
Vishal Subramanian is a wildlife photographer and a recent graduate of the University of California, Berkeley. Back in the fall, he and two other undergraduate student researchers, Harper Forbes and Prakrit Jain, decided to find a Mount Lyell shrew.
I think this would be a little crazy, but it would also be really cool to, you know, document this animal that's never been photographed alive.
So they set off into the Sierra Nevada mountains with a lot of plastic cups to set traps in the ground to try to catch this elusive creature.
Shrews are quite fast and not very personable, at least at first. They're always running away. If you try to pick them up, sometimes they might try to bite.
Prakrit Jain is still a student at Berkeley, and he says before you can even think about the taming of the shrew, you first got to catch one alive.
We got a shrew.
Once you catch one, you have to act quickly, because this shrew has a very fast metabolism. That means if they don't eat every few hours, they can die in the traps.
It was pretty much just go, go, go. And we never really slept for more than 2 hours at a time. And throughout the course of the 3 nights and 4 days, we probably never slept for more than 8 hours because we were just constantly trapping, photographing, then trapping again.
Their traps caught a lot of shrews, several different species actually, but the researchers suspected that at least 5 of them were the ones they were actually looking for.
This month, genetic testing confirmed that these undergraduate students had indeed taken the first known photographs of the Mount Lyell shrew.
It may seem like a lot of work to snap a photo, but Subramanian says it's actually really important for the world to see these furry little animals. He points to studies that show how other small mammals in the region are at risk with their habitat rapidly warming. And this shrew and its long snout help put a face to the impacts of climate change on biodiversity.
A majority of species that are disappearing aren't these, you know, traditionally charismatic species you hear about, like lions and wolves. But it's often these smaller, often overlooked animals that are disappearing completely under the radar with no public awareness or attention.
These researchers say that they dream of exploring far-off and distant places, but they realize that the breakthrough they made in what was already a well-studied part of the world shows there's still a lot to learn closer to home.
And if you are wondering what the Mount Lyell shrew actually looks like, check out the social media sites of the California Academy of Sciences.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Juana Summers. 4 years ago tomorrow, the military of Myanmar deposed the elected government led by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. She remains in jail, and the country is mired in a brutal civil war, largely forgotten by the outside world. Michael Sullivan reports from neighboring Thailand.
On the morning of February 1st, an aerobics instructor in the capital, Naypyidaw, captured the beginning of the coup in real time while filming her routine. Behind her, dozens of military vehicles streamed down the wide boulevard headed for parliament to prevent the elected government from convening. But it didn't take long for the people to resist, plunging the country into turmoil. 4 years later, the United Nations says more than 3.5 million people have been displaced by the fighting, with more than 15 million, nearly a third of the population, facing acute food insecurity. Mary Callahan is a Myanmar scholar at the University of Washington.
I think where we are now is there are pockets of famine all over the country. There are families who are very lucky to have some rice, absolutely no meat, but maybe fish paste or an egg for protein. The situation is quite bleak.
Not just in contested areas, but in government-controlled areas, like Myanmar's biggest city, Yangon, where the economy has collapsed, supply chains are in tatters, and prices are soaring, with ordinary people bearing the brunt of the economic crisis, according to the World Bank. This woman, who wants to remain anonymous out of fear of reprisal, is a single parent who cares for two elderly relatives with diabetes and heart problems. She says the price for a pack of 10 blood pressure tablets has soared from just 300 chat to about 12,000 chat since the coup. She spends most of her money on medicine for her parents and has stopped taking hers to save money. Her job and savings are gone. She's selling off her remaining jewelry to survive. In conflict areas, the situation is even worse. The military targets combatants and civilians alike as it battles the insurgents. 29-year-old Nay Chi is a medic for one of the People's Defense Forces battling the government outside Myanmar's second city, Mandalay. In emergencies, those hurt can't reach proper medical facilities in time to be saved, she says, because of bad roads. Plus, even if we can get them there, government hospitals won't treat those wounded by the military. And there are a few doctors left there anyway, with most of the medical staff having joined the civil disobedience movement after the coup. This doctor is one of them. She asked not to be named for security reasons and is secretly treating patients in Yangon.
To address the staffing gap, the junta has allowed less qualified students to pass medical school entry and specialist exams, and now both the quantity and the quality of medical staff have declined.
Analysts say the health system has all but collapsed. The shortage of healthcare facilities countrywide has also caused TB and malaria to spike, with cholera outbreaks rampant as well, none of which is acknowledged by the military, and all of which, doctors say, pose a risk not just to Myanmar, but to the region in general, with no sign of an end to the civil war in sight. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Chiang Rai.
If you hear something interesting, you might prick up your ears. That's a figurative expression, of course. People's ears don't actually move upward. But NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce found that this old term seems to hold a bit of truth.
While taking horseback riding lessons recently, Stephen Hackley got this advice.
pay close attention to the horse's ears. He says anyone with a pet understands why. You can learn a lot by tracking the movement of an animal's ears.
So you can tell which direction a cat or a dog is paying attention to. You can also pick up on emotions.
Hackley is a researcher with the University of Missouri. He says in almost every species, lifting up the ears is a clue
that the animal is putting some work into it. They're paying close attention, they're concentrating.
So, what about humans? People have some vestigial muscles around the ear. They never get used, except by those people who are able to deliberately wiggle their ears as a party trick. Hackley is part of a research team that put electrodes on those muscles to record subtle electrical signals.
In this experiment, we recorded from two different ear muscles, one that raises the ears up and one that pulls the ear back.
20 volunteers got wired up with electrodes around their ears and sat in a lab surrounded by speakers. They were told to pay attention to a certain audiobook. Andreas Schroer of Saarland University in Germany says the audiobook was picked to be engaging.
Fun little trivia that people could actually motivate themselves to listen to.
He says after a little while, though, other sounds got faded in at different volumes. These were picked to be distracting.
Those were also some podcasts we got. One of them was actually about the history of podcasts.
The goal was to create levels of difficulty in listening as the volunteers tried to tune in to that fun audiobook. Hackley says as the listening task got easier and harder, the researchers saw changes in the signals to one particular ear muscle.
The muscle that lifts the ear upwards, that perks the ear, it varied according to the amount of effort that the subject put in on the task.
It was as if the body was doing its best to perk up the ears, just as our evolutionary ancestors would have done, even though we lost this ability about 25 million years ago. What's more, when listeners were trying to pay attention to sound coming from a speaker behind them, that other ear muscle showed electrical activity, that muscle that, in animals, pulls the ear back. These results appear in the journal Frontiers in Neuroscience. Alex Francis is a professor of speech, language, and hearing sciences at Purdue University, who wasn't part of the research team. He says having a new way to measure how much effort someone is making in order to listen could be very important, because trying to hear can sometimes be so exhausting and frustrating, people just give up.
We have very, very good hearing aids now. They can provide very, very good amplification. And yet people still aren't happy wearing them sometimes. People sometimes still find it more challenging to listen through a hearing aid.
But if a hearing aid could monitor these muscles around the ear, the device could potentially get information about how a person was experiencing the act of listening and then make adjustments that could help. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Just a few years after creating the British funk outfit Simandé, its founders went in another direction. I met a lot of lawyers who'd like to be big music stars, but never the other way around. What were you thinking?
It's backward thinking, actually.
Four decades on, they're back. Find out why, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Juana Summers. The wildfires that tore through Los Angeles upended life for thousands, including many who work in the music industry.
I was truly thinking, like, there is no way I want to go back and buy all this music equipment that I've been gathering for 20 years now.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Another fiery crash involving a small plane tonight. Pennsylvania's governor says it happened near a mall in northeast Philadelphia. The FAA says two people were on board when the plane went down in a populated area less than 3 miles from an airport that serves businesses and business and charter flights. The Department of Education announced today that it plans to return to enforcing Title XI protections on the basis of, quote, biological sex in schools and on campuses. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
In a letter to schools, the Trump administration says it is reverting back to previous rules enacted in 2020 under Trump's first presidency, essentially getting rid of discrimination protection based on gender identity and sexual orientation, protections expanded under the Biden administration in 2024. Biden's rules faced a number of lawsuits, and earlier this year, a federal judge in Kentucky struck down Biden's regulations, saying that the administration had exceeded its authority and that the rules violated the Constitution and therefore were not enforceable in schools, colleges, and universities. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
The FDA has approved a new kind of pain medication. It works differently from opioids after surgery. It's being touted as a non-addictive alternative. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more on the drug and the company.
Stuart Arbuckle, who's executive vice president for Vertex Pharmaceuticals, which makes this new drug called Journavx, his company spent two decades developing it, and it works basically by blocking pain signals from the place in your body where you're hurt.
They inhibit the signal being transmitted to the brain. Other medicines, like opioids, for instance, work in the brain.
The FDA says the side effects seen in clinical studies were fairly mild. This is NPR. Social media accounts have incorrectly identified a transgender pilot as having flown that Black Hawk helicopter that collided with an American Airlines jet in Washington, D.C. this week. NPR's Odette Youssef has more.
Similar transphobic scapegoating happened after the school shootings in Uvalde, Texas, Apalachee, Georgia, Madison, Wisconsin, and Perry, Iowa, to name just a few. Sarah Moore is with GLAAD, an LGBTQ advocacy group. She says the pattern ties to a steep increase they've documented over the last 3 years of anti-trans hate crimes.
Trans people are 4 times more likely to be the victim of crimes, not the perpetrators.
In his first 2 weeks in office, President Trump has targeted trans people's access to medical care, bathrooms, and legal recognition on documents like passports. Trans people make up less than 1% of the U.S. population. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
Another federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's efforts to freeze trillions of dollars in federal grants, loans, and assistance programs. That judge in Boston siding with nearly 24 states that requested an emergency order to prevent the Trump administration from halting the funding. The Office of Management and Budget rescinded the sweeping order earlier this week, but the White House says it still plans to review spending to ensure it aligns with the president's agenda. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. President Trump has promised to pull a U-turn on electric vehicles. The Biden administration had a suite of policies promoting cleaner cars. Trump has plans to undo pretty much all of them. But the federal government does not turn on a dime, and neither does the auto industry. NPR's Camila Domonoske covers the world of cars. Hi, Camila.
Hi, Sasha.
Give us a sense of the range of things Trump is trying to roll back.
Yeah, it's a lot. These are policies that Biden had endorsed in order to support cleaner cars and specifically American-made electric vehicles. You can break it up into two big buckets. One is carrots, so think money for EV chargers or tax credits to make EVs cheaper. And then the other bucket has sticks, like emissions and fuel economy standards that are so strict that automakers have to make EVs to meet them. And then there's also some really important rules at the state level, driven mostly by California, maybe a third bucket there.
So beyond just cancel everything, what are the changes that are coming for these policies?
Yeah, you know, we know what the direction is, but we don't know the details. So the rules are going to be loosened, the money is going to be cut, but how loose, how much money, how fast, this is all very much TBD. Some of this needs to go through agencies, there's steps. Some is going to be debated in Congress, and some of it's going to ultimately be decided by the courts, and there could really be surprises along the way. You know, a few days ago, I would have told you very confidently that if we're talking about changes to the vehicle regulations, the earliest they could kick in would be a few years from now, because there's always some time to adjust. But the new Secretary of Transportation has just ordered his agency to evaluate these rules starting 3 years in the past. So regulations about vehicles already built and sold. I was at a meeting about auto regulations in D.C. when that news dropped. I can tell you nobody in the industry expected that start date.
Does that mean there are parts of the industry feeling the effect immediately?
So everything I just talked about, really, there's steps to be taken. Status quo's in place for now and things like tax credits. But then you look at things like EV chargers. One of the things Trump did immediately was he froze the disbursement of money that the government had allocated specifically for building more EV chargers, particularly in places where chargers are needed but not really profitable. And this is a funding freeze, by the way, that is still in place. It's not that other funding freeze that got reversed. So companies that have approval to build these chargers, including like truck stop chains that want to add plugs next to their gas stations, they are right now confused about whether they're going to get that money. Armando Rivera Jacobo is a lawyer who works on infrastructure projects, and he says they still might.
At the end of the day, there is a contract, and so far the government hasn't said that they will not satisfy their obligations under those contracts.
And if the government does back out, that would trigger lawsuits, he says. But that does have impact on companies right now.
Does this mean the auto industry will basically decide we can't make electric vehicles anymore?
Well, no, because look, the industry is not just responding to the U.S. government when they think about EVs. They're looking at consumers who are demanding some electric vehicles, regulations in other countries. They're worried about being able to compete with China, which is making very popular EVs. So yes, there's a ton of uncertainty. And Sasha, we haven't even talked about Elon Musk or tariffs, but whatever happens with the U-turn on U.S. policy, companies are still going to make EVs. It is a question how quickly the industry is going to move.
Camila Domonoske covers cars for NPR. Thanks, Camila.
Thanks.
In his inauguration address, President Trump vowed to rebalance the scales of justice. The president faced off against the Justice Department in two federal criminal cases until they were dropped after he won the election. NPR just reported that some career FBI officials were told to resign or be fired next week. NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson has more about Trump's efforts to quickly clean house at the Justice Department.
Trump's nominee to lead the Justice Department, Florida lawyer Pam Bondi, has not yet won confirmation by the Senate, but that hasn't stopped the fast and furious effort to reassign or fire longtime civil servants.
this is dreadful mistreatment by the Trump administration of career public servants.
That's David Allman. He worked at the Justice Department for more than 17 years under both Republican and Democratic presidents. Allman's watched with dismay as acting officials in charge at the DOJ have reassigned veteran supervisors who worked on environmental protection.
President Trump is making clear that he does not intend to hold polluters accountable for exposing communities across America to harmful pollution.
The changes don't end there. The acting attorney general transferred lawyers with decades of experience handling civil rights, extraditions, and national security into a new office that covers immigration enforcement. That's a key priority of the new president. Justice Department workers think that's designed to get them to quit. One of them already has. Corey Amundson ran the Public Integrity Unit at the Justice Department. He got that nonpartisan job during the first Trump administration, after years prosecuting corrupt public officials. But his government service ended after he refused to be shunted to that immigration enforcement office this week. Then came this news.
More than a dozen Department of Justice employees who worked on the criminal prosecutions of President Trump have been fired. Those who worked on Special Counsel Jack Smith's team were targeted.
The acting attorney general cited their work on the January 6th and classified documents cases against Trump and said they could not be trusted to carry out the president's agenda. Sally Yates spent a quarter century at the Justice Department, ending with a stint as acting attorney general at the end of the Obama years. Trump fired her in early 2017 after she refused to carry out his first travel ban for people from majority Muslim countries. Yates says she's more concerned about the institution now.
Firing civil servants who sought to hold him accountable is really a twofer for President Trump. He gets to retaliate and exact vengeance against prosecutors for just doing their jobs while also intimidating everyone across government and beyond.
Yates says that's no way to run a department entrusted with the impartial administration of justice. NPR spoke with nearly a dozen DOJ veterans this week. None could remember a time when a team of prosecutors had been fired for their work on a particular case. Meantime, Ed Martin, the interim U.S. attorney in Washington, launched an internal review over that office's handling of hundreds of cases against January 6th rioters. Martin previously played a role in the Stop the Steal election fraud movement and sat on the board of a group that supported January 6th defendants. Mary McCord worked at the Justice Department nearly 25 years. She worries this is the start of something bigger.
What does that start? Are we now going to be in a cycle of every change in administration, there's retribution against those who took positions, whether it's prosecutorial positions or policy positions that, you know, you disagreed with?
Alberto Gonzalez led the Justice Department under President George W. Bush. He says every president's elected on a set of law enforcement priorities, and those deserve a lot of discretion and support. But Gonzalez says it may be hard for new political appointees to get the very large DOJ moving in the direction they want. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Michael Shannon is best known for acting. He starred in Shape of Water and Boardwalk Empire, and he's currently busy doing things off camera. He debuts as a director in the movie Eric LaRue out this spring, and his REM cover band is hitting the road. These projects all feel fitting for Shannon, who says that change is the only constant in his life.
When you act, you create these little societies or civilizations to create some piece of art, and then you finish and they disappear, and it's kind of like the rhythm of my life. And there's certain relationships that carry on through those, or people that you work with on multiple occasions. But for the most part, you get very accustomed to things not being stable or reliable or things changing, you know.
Michael Shannon talked with Wildcard host Rachel Martin about some of the other changes he's experienced.
What does age teach you about love?
Oh my God.
Is that a good oh my God or a bad one?
No, it just moved me. They're very linked, obviously, age. I think, you know, when you're young, love is very self, can be very self-serving. You're like, you want love from other people. You want to have love or to have, you know, a relationship. And then as you get older, you realize that it's probably ultimately more important to love others regardless of what you get in return.
Yeah.
It becomes hopefully less transactional and more just a state of being, you know, which is, can be hard to accept.
I had a conversation with my sister that you just reminded me of that is, it's a thing that I've learned as you get old about love, that it's just you. It's all you got, actually, is you.
Yeah.
And if you can't be okay with you, then it's harder to love people without expectation or attachment or consequence. And and that's hard. I don't think that comes naturally to any of us. That's a tough lesson.
Well, and it's liberating in a way, if you can really do it in an honest, authentic way, it's actually very freeing. But it, unfortunately, it seems to be something you can't get to without experiencing a fair amount of pain.
Yeah.
Michael
Shannon's new movie, Eric LaRue, will be out this spring. You can see him on tour covering REM's Fables of the Reconstruction album this winter. Michael, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Michael Shannon is heading out on tour with his REM cover band in February. His directorial debut, the movie Eric LaRue, is out in March. You can hear more of that conversation with Michael Shannon on the Wildcard podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Every year, we run a series introducing you to first-time Grammy nominees. And we were right in the middle of reporting that series when the terrible fires broke out in the Pacific Palisades and Altadena. Those fires have disrupted the lives of thousands of Angelenos, including hundreds who work in the music industry, destroying their homes, studios, gear, entire livelihoods. So for this last day of this year's Grammys series, we wanted to pull away from the Grammys themselves and tell you the story of one artist who lost everything. It's just a glimpse into this painful time for so many of our city's musicians, so many singers, composers, producers, and engineers. On a recent afternoon at NPR West, I got to sit down with rapper Tony Obi, who performs as Fat Tony.
Beautiful, ain't it? Doing me, getting money, creating. If you can do you for the rest of your life and get paid, then you made it.
Tony evacuated the night of the Eaton fire with just a few changes of clothes and a laptop. And last Friday, he returned for the first time since the fires to find a pile of rubble where his home once stood.
And I was thinking that I'd go in there and maybe I'd rummage through and find some stuff. Like, there is nothing. And the only thing left standing is the fireplace, which I loved. You know, I had a lot of wonderful moments at that fireplace over the holidays. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for that. Truly grateful for that.
What was special to you about Altadena, about that particular neighborhood?
I love that it's a historic Black neighborhood, much like where I'm from, Third Ward, Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. I love that it's a diverse neighborhood. I love that there were all these great small businesses popping up. You know, a lot of people are talking about rebuilding, moving back there one day. For me right now, I truly feel like my Altadena dream is dead. I feel like it's time for me to come up with a new dream, with like a new perfect neighborhood, perfect life for me. Altadena was where I had my full heart and soul and my hopes and my dreams placed. It's going to take some time until I feel that way again about a neighborhood.
Can I talk more about that? Because it's hurting my heart to hear you say that you want to just start over and have a totally new dream begin, because there was so much that you did love in Altadena that is worth maybe hanging on to. I mean, you had more than a dozen albums at the point that the fires arrived. All your equipment, all your merch, all your records, I get it. All of that had been lost. But has there been any part of you that feels like just walking away completely from music?
I mean, honestly, that was my first thought when I had the fire. You know, I was truly thinking, like, there is no way I want to go back and buy all this music equipment that I've been storing and gathering for at least 20 years now. You know what I mean? Since I was a teenager. But recently, some friends have been reaching out and sending me music gear. DJ Sun from Houston is sending me gear. Toro Imoa sent me some gear. I pulled it out the box, hooked it up to my laptop, and started messing around making a beat. Doing that, actually being in like practice of music, made me feel like, oh, it's not that crazy. I can slowly see myself doing music again, making music again, because music for me, you know, it has been my full-time career at times. It's been my hobby at times. It's been my passion at times.
But it's always been there.
My only outlet at times. But yeah, it's always been there.
I love that when you were doing a beat again, that you were starting to come back to life. It's like your heartbeat
totally came back.
And I hope you continue to preserve space for creativity like you're doing a little bit now. I mean, while you're getting order back into your life and buying new shoes and buying the underwear and getting your new house set up, but just like saving a little space to think about music.
Totally. You know? I'm right there with you, and I appreciate you pushing me to do that. I will say this, though. There's another overwhelming feeling that I'm getting from all this. There is a bit of gratitude in this, because I do feel like when you lose something, when like an opportunity ends or a living space is no longer your home, or whether there's a fire or there's even a death or whatever it may be, it's kind of opening space up for new things to enter your life.
Yeah.
Even if that feels daunting or feels painful or feels like something you want to run from. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling that too in this moment, especially now that I have a new home that I'm moving into. I miss all my stuff, but on one hand, I'm grateful to have a clean slate.
There is possibility for renewal.
Totally.
After destruction. It's kind of amazing listening to you voice hope. And I also know that even though you've been hurting so deeply after these fires, you're already helping other people right now. I mean, you're booked to perform at several benefits yeah. for fire victims in the next week. How do you manage all of that in your head and your heart? Because I'm just marveling at the reservoir of generosity that's still left in you.
Well, I feel super grateful for all the support that I've received. Like, I was overwhelmed by the amount of people that reached out to me in the first couple weeks of this. Like, this is just a horrible situation. There's no way around it. It is devastating. But that's not the main thing that plays in my mind. The main thing that plays in my mind is gratitude. I am alive. I am safe. I have FEMA. I have a GoFundMe that did well. I have opportunities to rebuild my life. And I think that I'm lucky to be a somewhat public person, to be an artist. I'm more visible than many other people. And many of those people are in Altadena or they're affected by the Eaton Fire. And I want to put a spotlight on them. So when people are giving me an opportunity where I can raise money or raise awareness for these others alongside me, I'm jumping at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now that I have a new home, now that I'm a little more settled, I'm ready to get right back to helping others. Absolutely.
I'm hooked in, all my life been grinding, but it's all about the time, and when it's right, you shining. Keep pushing till you find it.
Well, I just want to say, Tony, I am so moved listening to you hold on to compassion, to gratitude, and to hope right now. It really has been very touching to talk to you today.
Thank you so much.
Tony Obi performs as Fat Tony, and he lost his Altadena home in the Eaton Fire. Thank you so much for coming into NPR West today and sharing your story with all of us.
Absolutely. Much love to y'all.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance, dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.